"If this is one of the funeral storerooms," said Nicholas, in a voice tight with excitement, "then we're getting very close to the tomb now." "Yes," she cried. "Look, there's another doorway on the far side of this storeroom. Shine the light over there." The beam picked out the square opening, facing them across this lower chamber. It was inviting, beckoning them almost seductively. They almost ran down the last few steps into the chamber lined with the reed baskets and pottery wine jars, but as they reached the level floor of the stone room, they ran into an invisible barrier that stopped both of them dead and sent them reeling backwards. "God!" Nicholas clutched at his throat, his voice a strangled choke. "Get back! Got to get back!" Rhoann was sinking to her knees, also gasping and hunting for breath. "Nicky!" she tried to scream, but her breath was trapped in her lungs. She felt that a steel noose had encircled her chest, and as it tightened, the breath was being forced out of her. "Nicky, help me!" She was strangling, like a fish thrown up on the bank. The strength drained from her limbs, and her vision began to break up and fade. She did not have the strength to stand. He stooped over her and tried to lift her, but he was almost as weak. He felt his own legs buckling, no longer able to support even his own weight. 4 minutes, he thought desperately as he suffocated. That's all we've got. 4 minutes to brain death and oblivion. We have to get air. From behind her, he slipped his arms under her armpits and locked his hands together over her breasts. Again he tried to lift her, but his strength was gone. He began to walk backwards towards the stairs down which they had run so lightly, and every pace required a huge effort. She was already unconscious, lying inert in the circle of his arms. Her limp legs trailed across the stone floor as he dragged her back. The lowest step caught his heels, and he almost toppled over backwards. With an effort he regained his balance and lugged her back up the steps, her feet sliding and bumping loosely over the treads. He wanted to shout to Hanseth for help, but he did not have the air in his lungs to utter a sound. "If you drop her now, she's dead," he told himself, and he struggled up another 5 steps, his lungs hunting for precious air and finding none. His strength oozed out of him a drop at a time as his vision slid and wobbled and distorted. "Let me breathe," he pleaded. "Please, God, let me breathe." Miraculously, like a direct answer to his prayer, he felt the precious oxygen slide down his panting throat and swell his lungs. At once his strength began flooding back, and he tightened his grip around Royan's chest and lifted her bodily. He staggered up the remaining steps, with her body in his arms, and sprawled out of the mouth of the shaft onto the slabs of the tunnel at Hanseth's feet. "What is it, Effendi? What has happened to you and the lady?" Nicholas had no breath to answer him. He laid Rhoann in the position for mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and slapped her cheeks. "Come on," he pleaded with her. "Speak. Talk to me." There was no response. So he knelt over her, covered her open mouth with his own and blew down her throat until from the corner of his eye he saw her chest swelling and inflating. He sat back for a count of 3. "Please, my darling, please breathe." There was no colour in her yellow, corpse-like face. He bent over her and covered her mouth again, and as he filled her lungs with his own breath, he felt her stir under him. "That's it, my darling," he told her. "Breathe, breathe for me." In the next breath she pushed him away and sat up groggily, staring around at the circle of faces that hovered over her anxiously. She picked out Nicholas's pale face amongst the black faces of the men. "Nicky, what happened?" "I'm not sure. But whatever it was, it almost got both of us. How are you feeling now?" "It was as though an invisible hand had me by the throat and was strangling me. I couldn't breathe. And then I passed out." "It must be some kind of gas filling the lower levels of the passage. You were only out for less than 2 minutes," he reassured her. "It takes 4 minutes of oxygen starvation to kill the brain." I have a terrible headache. She pressed her fingers to her temples. I heard your voice calling me back. You called me my darling. She dropped her eyes. Oh, just a little slip of the tongue. He lifted her to her feet, and for a moment she swayed against him, her breast soft and warm against his chest. Thank you once again, Nicky. I am so deeply in your debt already, I'll never be able to repay you. Oh, I'm sure we'll be able to work something out. She was suddenly aware of the men's eyes watching her and drew away from him. What kind of gas? And how did it get in there? Was it another of Tater's tricks, do you think, Nicky? One of the gases of decay, most probably, was his opinion, because it is trapped in the lower part of the passage. It must be a heavier-than-air type. I would guess that it is probably carbon dioxide, although it could be something like methane. I think methane is heavier than air, isn't it? Did Taita do it deliberately? The colour was returning to her cheeks, and she was recovering swiftly. I don't know, but those baskets and jars are suspicious. I'll be able to answer that question when we've had a chance to examine their contents. He touched her cheek tenderly. How are you feeling? How's your headache? Better. What do we do now? Clear the gas from the chamber, he told her, and as soon as possible. He used a candle from his emergency pack to test for the gas level in the shaft. With it burning in his right hand, he went back down the steps, holding it low to the floor, descending a step at a time. The candle flame burned brightly, dancing to the movement of the air as he went down. Then, abruptly, on the sixth step above the floor level of the chamber, the flame turned yellow and snuffed out. He marked the level on the wall in white chalk and called up to the Royan at the head of the shaft. "Well, at least it's not methane. I'm still here. Must be carbon dioxide." "Pretty conclusive test," she laughed. "If it goes boom, it's methane." "Hansith, bring down the blower fan," Nicholas shouted to the big monk. Holding his breath as though he was snorkeling underwater, Nicholas carried the fan down the lower steps and set it up on the floor of the chamber. He set the fan speed at high and immediately retreated up the shaft, drawing a huge breath as soon as he was above the chalk mark on the wall. "How long will it take to clear the gas?" Royan asked anxiously, looking at her wristwatch. "I will test with the candle every 15 minutes." It was an hour before the gas had dispersed enough to enable him to reach the floor of the chamber again and breathe the air down there. Then Nicholas ordered Hansith to bring down a bundle of firewood and build a fire in the centre of the stone floor to heat and circulate the air more rapidly. While he was doing this, Nicholas and Royan examined one of the baskets that stood against the wall. "A crafty old ruffian," Nicholas muttered, half in exasperation and half in admiration. "It looks like a mixture of manure and grass and dead leaves, the same as a compost heap." They crossed the chamber, turned one of the pottery jars on its side, and studied the powder that spilled out of it. Nicholas took up a handful and rubbed it between his fingers, then sniffed it warily. "Crushed limestone," he muttered. "Although it's long ago dried out and lost any odour, Taita probably soaked it with some form of acid. Vinegar, perhaps, or even urine would have done the trick. As it broke down the limestone, it formed carbon dioxide." "So it was another deliberate trap," Royan exclaimed. "Even so many thousands of years ago, Taita must have understood the processes of decay. He knew what gases those mixtures would produce. Amongst all the other accomplishments he boasts of, he must also have been a nifty chemist. Furthermore, he must have known that without a draught or any movement of air, these heavy inert gases would hang here in the bottom of the chamber indefinitely," she agreed. "I expect that this shaft is designed like a U-trap. I bet that the passage rises again." She pointed at the mysterious doorway in the far hall. "In fact, I can see the first steps even from here." "We'll soon find out if you're right," he told her, "because that's exactly where we're heading right now. Up those steps." Sapper had placed cairns of stones at the water's edge to monitor the river level. He watched them the way a stockbroker watches his ticker tape. It had been 6 hours since the last rain squall had passed. The clouds over the valley had burned away in the hot, bright sunlight, although they still hung densely over the northern horizon. Their great dun-coloured thunderheads reared to the heavens, menacing and ominous, forming their own mighty ranges that dwarfed the mountains beneath them. At any time the downpour might begin up there in the highlands. Once that happened, Sapper wondered how long it would take the floodwaters to reach them here in the Abbey Gorge. He dismounted stiffly from the tractor and went down the bank to inspect his stone markers. The water level had fallen almost a foot in the past hour. He forced himself not to let his optimism bubble over. After all, it had taken only 15 minutes for the river to rise the same amount. The final outcome was inevitable. The rains would come. The river would spate. The dam would burst. He looked downstream at the dam wall and shook his head with resignation. He'd done as much as possible to delay that moment. He had raised the level of the dam wall almost 4 feet, had packed in another buttress behind the wall to strengthen it. There was nothing further for him to do, and he could only wait. Climbing up the bank, he leaned warily against the yellow steel of his machine and looked across at his team of buffaloes, strewn along the bank like casualties on a battlefield. They had worked for 2 days to hold back the waters, and now they were exhausted. He knew that he could not call on them for another effort. The next time the river attacked, it would overwhelm them. He saw some of the men stir and sit up, and their faces turned upstream. He heard their voices faint on the wind. Something was exciting their interest. He climbed up onto the tractor and shaded his eyes. The unmistakable figure of Mac Nimmer was coming down the trail from the direction of the escarpment, stocky and powerful in his camo fatigues, his gait determined. He was accompanied by two of his company commanders. Mac hailed Sapper from a distance. "How is your dam holding?" he called in Arabic, which Sapper did not understand. "Soon it will rain on the mountains. You won't be able to hold out here much longer." But his gestures towards sky and river were immediately intelligible to Sapper. Sapper jumped down from the machine to greet him, and they shook hands cordially. They had recognized in each other the qualities of strength and professionalism that they both admired. Mac seized his company commander, who spoke English, by the arm, and the man fell into his by now familiar role of interpreter. "It is not only the weather that troubles me," Mac confided in a low voice, and the interpreter relayed the information to Sapper. "I have reports that the government troops are moving into position to attack us. My intelligence is that they have a full battalion moving down this way from Deborah Mariam, and another force below the monastery at St. Frumentius, moving up the Abbey River." "Pincer movement, eh?" said Sapper. Mac listened to the translation and nodded gravely. "I am heavily outnumbered, and I don't know how long I will be able to hold them when they attack. My men are guerrillas. It is not our role to fight set-piece battles. It is the war of the flea for us, hit and run. I come to warn you to be ready to pull out at short notice." "Don't worry too much about me," Sapper grunted. "I'm a sprinter. 100 yards dash is my speciality. It's Nicholas and Royan you should be thinking of. Them and that ruddy rabbit warren of theirs. I am on my way to them now, but I wanted to arrange a fallback position. If we get cut off from each other in the fighting, Nicholas has cached the boats at the monastery. That is where we will assemble." "Okay, Mac." Sapper stopped speaking, and all three of them looked up the trail, where there was a fresh disturbance amongst the men along the bank.